So China is the largest communist nation on Earth with one of the world's largest economies. And with its role in market capitalism around the world, you have to remind yourself that the People's Republic is run by a communist party with 80 million members. That party used to control every major industry in China, but in the past 20 years, most state-owned enterprises have been sold off. And today, the party is trying to make its way back onto the shop floor and into the offices of the exploding private sector economy. Chinese Vice President Xi Jinping, the man expected to become China's top leader in the fall, is in Washington today as part of a five-day trip to the U.S., a moment to reflect on what the Communist Party's role is in modern China these days. Joining us is James Fallows, national correspondent for The Atlantic magazine. James, great to talk to you again.
It's a pleasure to be on the show. Thanks very much.
So, James Fallows, I read a short piece in The Economist. It seems like every couple of weeks they have a cover piece on China. You know, a lot of business magazines do. It's an indication of China's significance in the world. But it was all about how the Chinese Communist Party is attempting to get itself back onto the shop floor and have the kind of influence it used to have with the old cadre system of generations ago. What is the influence and role of the Chinese Communist Party as you see it these days?
I think in day-by-day business operation of the parts of Chinese businesses that really are growing, that we really hear about and read about and whose products we consume, it has a vanishingly small influence. For example, the factories of southern China, where the components for most electronic devices come from and where probably every computer a listener is now using was assembled. I remember talking to a manager of one of those big companies and asking him where the local headquarters of the Communist Party was and who ran it. He said, you know, he'd never known. He'd never even had any dealings there. And so in much of the country, the Communist Party has almost no ideological effect, but does have some quasi-state effect. That they're in if you go to one of the provinces, there are parallel governments. There's the state and the city government, and then there's the Communist Party secretary for each of those places. So it's mainly an organizational tool now. I don't think I've met a single young Chinese person for which the communist ideal had any significance, but as a sort of career-building measure, it's something that some people go into as a way to have longer-term opportunities.
Membership looks good on your resume, but it does appear that the Chinese government is thinking that this top-down approach, as you've described it, to the exploding private sector has maybe run its course, and it's time to actually get some boots on the ground in some of these businesses. The People's Daily was describing how they were putting cadres on the shop floor to watch labor practices, even though the labor department, the labor office of the Chinese Communist Party doesn't even have a phone number.
That's not surprising that they did. Who knows whether it would go anyplace. I think one of the surprises for me over the last now almost 6 years, mainly in China, has been how contradictory organizational schemes and explanations are simultaneously true. It's true that most of the growth in China has been bottom-up and by small enterprises that are dealing with foreign suppliers and foreign contractors. And also, there are still some significant top-down directives. Some of the largest firms in China are still either state-owned or very significantly state-influenced. And then there's this gray zone. If you go to many of the provinces around the country, you see the huge construction projects are done not so much by the National Communist Party nor by purely individual entrepreneurs, but by some local governor's initiative. And he will be a communist figure, and there will be a communist gloss to what he's doing, but it's largely what we would think of as old-style local boosterism to get commerce going in the middle of the country.
And in the days of Mao and in the early days of Deng Xiaoping, there were all sorts of enterprises in China which were required to hold communist cadres on their payroll, either individuals who are associated with the provincial governor, as you suggest, and others. Is it possible for the Chinese government to enforce that sort of thing today if they were to insist that the Communist Party members actually be employees of even foreign-owned companies?
There are versions of that still. For example, as I believe you reported on the show over the years, Walmart, the only part of the world where Walmart is unionized, is in China because Officially, communist-blessed unions have been, Walmart has been forced to include them among its workforce in lots of its big outlets in China. And so the larger the enterprise, the more suspect it is and subject it is to these requirements from either the state or the central government about having having Communist Party officials there. I guess the main point that's struck me and surprised me again and again is that we would think of a Communist Party cadre as having some ideological component to what he or she was doing. That was really hard to see on the shop floors or the offices in China. It seems to be much more purely reporting to headquarters and organizational coordination as opposed to anything we'd view as old-style communist doctrine.
Well, finding any sort of old-style Maoist ideology in China is a bit of archaeology these days. It's nowhere to be seen. But on the issue of reporting to headquarters, one of the criticisms or worries or concerns, even among foreign-owned subsidiaries, about this phenomenon of attempting to get communist cadres into these private enterprises was that the Chinese government may be interested in creating a network of observers who can monitor unrest on factory floors in the provinces or even conduct industrial espionage. Is that possible?
Yes, I think all those things are possible and likely, and they probably preceded this latest wave of trying to get more Communist Party representation. And they're interestingly different concerns that the enterprises and the government will have for the monitoring. Certainly on industrial espionage, that's something that every foreign business dealing in China has to figure out its way to manage or either live with or ignore or whatever. On unrest, that actually is quite a serious problem for factory owners, entirely apart from political issues, just because, especially in the southern half of China, wages have been rising so rapidly, and health concerns for a lot of the workforce that employers are wondering, will the workers come back after their vacations at the spring holidays, et cetera. The government's concern, of course, is different. There is so much dispersed popular discontent that the government needs a way to stay on top of that, and so this is one more tool.
Fascinating. Well, before we go, in the minute and a half we have left, Chinese Vice President Xi Jinping, he's going to be China's top leader in the fall. He's going to Iowa for a kind of a agricultural reunion with some old pals from the 1980s. Who is this man, and what do you make of him?
He is expected to be more colorful than Hu Jintao, he's expected to succeed later this year, who's been seen as a more or less pure technocrat. He's somebody who has had a number of he's paid his price during the Cultural Revolution when his family was on the outs. He has at least professed within China to have some kind of romantic and excited memories of his time when he visited the U.S. 20 years ago. So I think the main expectation from the U.S. point of view is that the organization is stronger than any of the individuals now in it. So it was surprising if there's much change in policy, but at least there will be a new face for a while.
Although I understand he has a daughter at Harvard, you think he can get Jeremy Lin tickets, Knicks tickets? What do you think?
That will be a real sign of China becoming the strongest country on earth, if that's so.
Oh, that's the takeaway of the day. Happy Valentine's Day, James Fallows.
Thanks so much. My pleasure.
James Fallows, national correspondent for The Atlantic. Well, he's in Washington today, but when Chinese Vice President Xi Jinping visits Iowa tomorrow, it will be a personal reunion for the Chinese leader. He'll go back to Muscatine to see old friends from a previous visit to eastern Iowa in 1985. The visit is expected to produce some new agricultural trade agreements, and there will be a state dinner at the Iowa Capitol, all part of what some Iowans are calling the most significant visit here by a foreign dignitary since Pope John Paul II came to Des Moines in October of 1979. And joining us now is Kirk Leeds, who's the CEO of the Iowa Soybean Association, who's going to be watching this visit very, very closely. Welcome to the program, Kirk.
John, it's great to be with you.
So what do you expect from the Chinese vice president? What is of interest to the soybean growers of Iowa?
Well, certainly we're excited. The whole state's excited about this high-level visit of the Chinese vice president. You know, we expect to, as you indicated in the introduction, reacquaint with some old friends that the vice president had back in the 80s. But we're going to be talking, of course, in Iowa, we're going to talk about agriculture, and we're going to talk about the importance of soybeans. In my case, we'll be having an opportunity to talk about soybeans and remembering that China really imported almost 60% of all the global trade in soybeans last year. So they're a major player, and we're going to talk about that. We're going to say thank you, and we're going to remind the Chinese that Iowa and the Midwest is a partner when it comes to providing a sustainable way to feed their growing population.
So when you talk to the Chinese trade reps, you probably don't say the word sorghum very much. You say tofu a little more, right?
Well, certainly. Soybeans, as you may know, came from China. They were actually historically came from China, mostly in with tofu. But today, the predominant use of soybeans in China is for soybean meal, which is fed to their growing livestock.
Is that right? So what is the value of the current soybean relationship with China right now, and what could it get to?
Well, last year we exported just over $12 billion worth of U.S. soybeans to China. We expect that's going to continue to grow at a 5 to a 10% increase every year for the next several years. And again, most of that growth is occurring because of the need for animal protein. They're the world's largest producer of hogs. They produce five times as many hogs as we do. Pork is a very important part of the Chinese diet. They've also become very, very large in aquaculture. They produce about 60% of all the fish in the world. And from a soybean perspective, that equates to about 250 million bushels of soybeans just in China each year, which is more than half of what Iowa produces every year in soybeans. And we're the leading producing soybean state in the country.
So when I'm popping back the edamames, I'm actually eating fish food.
Well, certainly you can process soybeans. Edamame is actually an immature soybean that's made specifically for salads, but a type of soybeans, a more mature soybean, is harvested across the country. And that soybean, that little bean, is processed into two major products. You've got soybean meal, which, as I said, is fed mostly to animal livestock, and you get vegetable oil, which is obviously used in cooking and salad dressings. And when people's income goes up, the first thing they add to their diet is vegetable oil for cooking and ingredients. And secondly, they want to add more protein. First of all, vegetable protein, which comes from soybeans. Secondly, meat protein, which is fed soybean meal and U.S. corn.
Great place to be if you're Kirk Leeds, CEO of the Iowa Soybean Association, hoping to get some face time with the Chinese vice president. Kirk, thanks so much and good luck to you.
Thank you very much.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.